Astrid Eichhorn back at PI. So she will tell us about asymptotic safety with Matthew.
Thanks, Ado. And it's really great to be back at PI, and thanks for the opportunity, for giving me the opportunity to give a talk here. So I'll be reporting on recent progress on the asymptotic safety paradigm for gravity and matter. And this will be based on work with my postdoc, Nick Christiansen, one of my PhD students, Aaron Held, as well as work together with Stefan Nippold and Jan Pawlowski. And so the plan is that I'll briefly review the basics of the asymptotic safety paradigm. And I'll actually be assuming that you are mainly familiar with the basic idea. And then I'll give you a lightning review of the compelling hints that we have for the viability of asymptotic safety in pure gravity. And then for the most part of the talk, I'll be focusing on the question whether the asymptotic safety paradigm can not only provide us with a picture of quantum spacetime, but simultaneously provide us with an ultraviolet completion for the standard model of particle physics. And so I'll mainly be focusing on exploring quantum gravity effects on the standard model. And this will also be something that will allow me to start forging a link between Planck scale physics and between observable physics at lower scales, such as the electroweak scale. And of course, that link could ultimately help us to bring quantum gravity into the regime of observable physics. Please feel free to interrupt with questions at any point during the talk. So the asymptotic safety paradigm, let me briefly introduce the idea. So in any quantum field theory, quantum fluctuations generate scale-dependent or running couplings. That is, of course, very well known. And this can have dramatic consequences for the theory because it can lead to two different types of UV or high-energy behavior. In the first case, if quantum fluctuations actually generate a screening property of the medium, what that means is that as we zoom into higher momentum scales or smaller distance scales, the effective interaction strength grows. And then things can happen, like, for instance, in abelian gauge theories, where we ultimately encounter a Landau pole, so a divergence of the coupling. Of course, first of all, this is just a sign that perturbation theory breaks down. So then you can ask what happens beyond perturbation theory. And for instance, put that theory on a lattice. And then you essentially encounter the same type of problem. So we encounter what is known as the triviality problem. And the triviality problem is that if you push the scale at which you define your theory, if you try to push that to infinity, then at low energies, you will end up with a theory that has a vanishing coupling. So that is trivial. So that is known as the triviality problem. What that means is that such a theory is just one that is an effective theory. It holds over a finite range of scales, but it doesn't describe physics beyond that cutoff scale lambda here, which you should think of the scale where new degrees of freedom have to come in. And that triviality problem actually affects two sectors of the standard model, namely the lambda phi 4 theory, which is, of course, a building block of the Higgs sector, as well as the abelian gauge theory, which we, of course, have in the standard model as the U1 hypercharge. Now, the second type of UV behavior that we can have is when we have a so-called fundamental theory. So a fundamental theory is one where at high scales you reach a regime that is scale invariant. And of course, as you get into a scale invariant regime, you can then zoom into arbitrary high momentum scales without running into any divergences. And so this is what is known as a renormalization group fixed point. And there are actually two versions of that scale invariant UV regime. The better known one is asymptotic freedom, where the coupling simply approaches a vanishing value as you go towards the UV. And in the language of beta functions, this is encoded in a zero of the beta function. So that's a renormalization group fixed point. And that zero lies at the vanishing value of the coupling. The slightly less explored possibility that is in some sense just a generalization of asymptotic freedom, that is asymptotic safety. So here again, you have a scale invariant regime. And that scale invariant regime lies at a finite value of the couplings. So you have a scale invariant regime in which residual interactions are still present. And in beta functions, you detect such an asymptotically safe theory by finding a zero of the beta function at a finite value of the coupling. So that's the basic idea of asymptotic safety in a nutshell. It's really just a generalization of the very well-known and very successful asymptotic freedom paradigm. Now, asymptotic safety and asymptotic freedom both don't live in sort of simple one-dimensional cartoons as I drew them here. Both of them live in what is known as the theory space, and that's an infinite dimensional space. And it's a space of all couplings compatible with the symmetries of the model. The reason why we are living in this full space and not just in some one-dimensional version with just one coupling constant, is that quantum fluctuations will always generate all interactions which are compatible with the symmetries. And therefore, even if we start at some scale with a theory that has just one particular coupling, quantum fluctuations will generate all other interactions as we change our, the scale that we look at. And so asymptotic freedom as well as asymptotic safety are both statements about fixed points in this infinite dimensional theory space. And of course, since it's infinite dimensional, one of the important questions in this whole setup is, how do you then get to a setting where you just end up with a finite number of free parameters? And this will become really important also in the second part of the talk, because we will have what is called irrelevant directions, and those are the ones where we can actually extract predictions from asymptotic safety. So let me first explain what the relevant directions are. So those are the ones that are ultraviolet attractive, and they span a surface along which, wherever you start at low energies, on that surface you will always be attracted into the fixed point as you run towards high scales. Conversely, this means that there is no way for you to predict the low energy value of that coupling from the fixed point requirement. Because coming out of the fixed point, you can go anywhere on this blue surface. And so the UV attractive directions, they correspond to the free parameters of the model, which we have to fix by experiment. Now, in contrast, the UV repulsive directions, those are the ones along which you cannot actually reach the fixed point as you go towards the ultraviolet. And so here you are on trajectories where you will typically encounter something like a triviality problem. So conversely, what this means is that if you want to have a theory that makes sense on all scales, the value of, in this sketch, the coupling G2 is actually not free. You actually have to lie exactly on that blue surface, and this fixes the value of that coupling for you on all scales. And so that means that for those irrelevant directions, we can actually predict the value because there is only one specific value for which we can actually reach the UV fixed point. There's also the reverse way of thinking about the same thing, which is not thinking towards the ultraviolet, towards high scales, but thinking towards the infrared, towards low scales. And as you can see in this simple sketch here, for such an irrelevant direction, even if you start somewhere up here towards the infrared, you will be drawn towards that blue surface. So irrelevant directions are those for which towards the infrared quantum fluctuations actually force those couplings to have very specific values. In asymptotically free models, this is very well known. These are just all the higher order couplings, and their couplings, and these couplings are, of course, fully determined once we determine the relevant couplings. They do not by themselves correspond to relevant or to free parameters of the theory. Now, here's just a simple sketch where you can actually see this property that for irrelevant directions, quantum fluctuations drive them towards very specific values. So here we have a fixed point that has an irrelevant direction, namely the direction G2, and this is the flow towards the infrared. And you can see that you can start with quite a large range of values for that coupling G2 at high scales, and towards the infrared it will be mapped towards a much smaller range of values. So quantum fluctuations force that coupling G2 to go towards this particular value up here. And if you are on a trajectory that ends up in the fixed point in the UV, then G2 by itself is actually not a free parameter. It is completely sufficient to specify the value of G1, and that immediately tells you what the value of G2 is. And so therefore, that particular coupling G2 is something that we can predict within an asymptotically safe setting. And that will become later important later on when we try to understand quantum gravity effects on matter couplings. Now, before I tell you a little bit about the method that we use to search for asymptotic safety, let me first of all explain why you might expect that something like, for instance, quantum gravity should exhibit asymptotic safety. So what is the mechanism that generates asymptotic safety? Well, for that, let us immediately look at the case of gravity and specifically at the Newton coupling. And that, of course, has a non-vanishing mass dimensionality in four dimensions. And so therefore, if we look at the dimensionless Newton coupling, that capital G here, its beta functions has two contributions. One of the contributions is just from the classical scaling dimension. So this is just a canonical scaling contribution. This is just the scaling of the dimensionless G that you get automatically as you change your units. So this is just classical scaling. And then there's a term from quantum fluctuations, which is proportional to G squared, and which a priori could come with a positive or a negative sign. In this sketch here, I've chosen the negative sign, and that then clearly generates a non-trivial zero of the beta function. And so the mechanism that we have here that generates the zero of the beta function, so that generates the scale invariant regime here, is that we balance the canonical scaling, this linear term here, with the term from quantum fluctuations, so the quantum scaling. So we balance the two against each other and then generate a scale invariant regime in that way. So this, in principle, is a mechanism how you can get asymptotic safety in gravity. And there is actually a regime where we can test this in a really well-controlled setting, and this is in the vicinity of two dimensions. So in two dimensions, we can actually look at perturbative expansions. We can do an epsilon expansion around d equal 2. And this was actually already done quite a while back. And then you see that the beta function has exactly that form with the canonical scaling term and the term from quantum fluctuations. And that actually comes with a negative sign. And that's exactly the sign that you need for this mechanism that balances the two type of fluctuations and that generates the scale invariant regime in the UV. Now, of course, we don't really live in the vicinity of two dimensions. We live in four dimensions. And so the main question in this whole setting is whether this idea can be extended towards four dimensions. So in principle, of course, the structure of the beta function can be the same in four dimensions. So the crucial question is to understand whether this negative sign actually persists as we go towards four dimensions. Are there any questions so far? OK, then let's continue. So what we need is a tool that allows us to explore beta functions in four dimensions. And here, let me briefly introduce the functional renormalization group. Yeah?
So are you talking about quantum gravity in near two dimensions here?
Yes.
So how do you define a curvature, I don't know, in fractional dimensions?
Good question. Let me think about that. So just in a purely technical way, of course, you can just evaluate the loop integrals in general dimension, which you can just choose to be arbitrary. It doesn't have to be integer. So the physical interpretation of quantum gravity theory in, let's say, 2.1 dimension, that's, I think, a wholly different question. So this is more from a purely theoretical point of view, where you can take physical theories that live in, let's say, d equal 2 or d equal 3, and you can continuously connect them, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the d equal 2.1 dimensional theory actually makes physical sense.
I see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's more just the question of really getting a connection between the different dimensions that then allow you to understand whether such a mechanism that works here, whether you can extend that to the d equal 4 case. Okay. So let me briefly introduce the functional renormalization group that maybe some of you are already familiar with. So this is just a tool that allows us to probe the scale dependence of a quantum field theory. And let me first introduce this just for scalar theories, and I'll mention briefly a few things about the subtleties in a gravitational setting later on. So to probe the scale dependence in a quantum field theory, we introduce an additional mass-like term. So you see it's quadratic in the field, so it's clearly a mass. But it's not just a constant mass for all modes. It's a mass that depends on the scale k. And it also depends on the momentum of the modes. And so then you can choose this mass in such a way that it vanishes for high momentum modes. And so therefore, the path integral for the high momentum modes is completely unmodified. And quantum fluctuations at high scales contribute to the effective action gamma k. Now, in contrast, you can then choose this mass term for the low momentum modes in such a way that it is non-vanishing. So the low momentum modes come with a heavy mass. And that, of course, suppresses their fluctuations in the Euclidean path integral. And therefore, they do not yet contribute to the effective action at the scale k. And in this way, you can define this effective action that interpolates smoothly between the microscopic action and the full effective action in the limit where k goes to 0 and where all quantum fluctuations contribute. And in general, of course, this lives in this infinite dimensional theory space. So at all scales, you can write the effective action as just the sum of all possible integrated field monomials that you have in your particular theory times couplings. And these couplings, they are the ones that are scale dependent. And so as you change the scale k and integrate out further quantum fluctuations, the effective action will change, and it will be parameterized by a change in the couplings. And so, of course, when you then understand the scale dependence of the flowing action, from that you can easily just extract the beta functions. And this is, of course, what we are after. So we want to understand the beta functions in the case of gravity, search for non-trivial zeros. And in that way, what we will end up with is a prediction for the microscopic dynamics. So the scale dependence of the flowing action that we would like to understand, that is actually encoded in an exact functional equation, the Wetterich equation. And let me just briefly explain what the right-hand structure here means. So this whole object here, this is nothing but the full non-perturbative field and momentum-dependent propagator of the theory. And the supertrace essentially just gives you a summation over the eigenvalues of that propagator, or in a simple case, if you're looking at quantum field theories just on a flat background, then this just will just be the momentum integral, and this will be something like 1 over p squared plus this mass-like term plus further couplings. And so essentially what you have on the right-hand side here is just the momentum integral over the full non-perturbative propagator, and therefore structurally this is a one-loop equation. And what is really important is that it's structurally one loop, which means it's technically really useful for practical calculations. But it's not one loop in the sense of perturbation theory, because as it stands here, this equation is exact. It uses the full non-perturbative propagator. And in its derivation, you use nowhere any assumption about small couplings or anything like that. So this is not one loop in the sense of one loop perturbation theory. So there aren't any higher order terms that we are neglecting here. And so, of course, once you have solved the right-hand side of the equation, you can then just extract the beta functions for that and search for asymptotic safety. Now, of course, for practical calculations, there are approximations that we have to make, because this equation lives in this infinite-dimensional space of all couplings, and that's, of course, difficult to deal with. So for practical calculations, we take this infinite sum, and we truncate it to a typically finite-dimensional sum. In some cases, you can also do infinite-dimensional truncations. And of course, one of the crucial questions is, do we have control over the choice of operators? So of course, a truncation that works well is one that actually takes into account all the relevant physics, and where the things that are neglected will just be subleading corrections. And so then you can come up with particular schemes for truncations that work well. And of course, you can test whether the initial assumptions were justified by extending the truncation and including some of the operators you think are actually subleading, and just checking whether this is actually the case.
You said that you're not neglecting any higher order term, but
In the equation here, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wait, aren't you neglecting field fluctuations are higher than quadratic? You're taking the second variation of effective action and then.
No, so the effective action, you can then expand that in terms of the full. In a vertex expansion where the prefectors are really the prefectors of all the higher order endpoint functions. So this is really an exact identity. In fact, this is really just a reformulation of the full path integral. So essentially, this thing up here and this thing down here, in some sense, are just fully equivalent.
But then you need, for practical purposes, to expand it
For practical purposes, I mean, you know, if you were to write down this, really put in this full object in here, then of course the inversion of this complicated field-dependent operator, that becomes a very tough problem, right? And so therefore, for practical purposes, you then choose a typically finite-dimensional set where you actually can invert this differential operator that is also field-dependent.
But within the truncation, you can do that at all,
technical feasibility is of course another guiding principle in most cases to set up truncations. Okay.
Think I quite understood the answer to Flavio's question. So you are doing some Gaussian integral somewhere to get that trace, aren't you?
You're not doing a Gaussian integral, because in here you have all the higher order interaction terms. You're never actually doing any sort of Gaussian integral. Right. You're just you're defining the Legendre transform here. And then you're just looking at the scale derivative of this object here. And the scale derivative, if it hits this object back here, will involve something like the full non-perturbative two-point function. So this explains why you have that structure in here. But you're not making any approximation that you're truncating this action here to be anything like quadratic. So this is really a fully field-dependent thing. And therefore, also the propagator is actually the one that is fully field-dependent. So it's not just a 1 over p squared. It's also fully dependent on the higher order field terms.
So how do you get that trace then?
So the trace is essentially just a combination of, sort of technically speaking, essentially just the same integral that you put up here. So here you have, in this integral here, it's just an integration over the momentum, and it would be a more complicated trace if you had additional internal indices, for instance. Mm-hmm. And essentially it's this same thing, this integral here, that just comes down as an integral over the momenta down here. But yeah, so if you're interested in the derivation, it's really essentially just a sort of four-line thing. So we can also talk later.
Yeah, I would imagine. But you're saying you're not making an approximation.
Yeah, this is really an exact equation. It's just, in some sense, you can think of this as a reformulation of the full path integral. And then, of course, there is a conservation of difficulty. I mean, it's difficult to do the full path integral, so solving this equation exactly, that is difficult. But then you can make approximations in which you can solve this, and then you can check whether these approximations actually work or not.
Are you introducing a second metric when you...
Yeah, I'll come to that on the next slide. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
No, it's for this discussion, maybe it would be fair to say that this is the reformulation which suggests different kinds of approximations.
Yes.
Than one mm-hmm. would do if one simply naively expanded in terms of a coupling concept.
Yes. So I mean, this is sort of, you can do a perturbative expansion with this, as you would do with the path integral, but you can also come up with other truncation schemes, which, for instance, work like a derivative expansion, and which we would maybe not necessarily do to the path integral as it stands here. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a fair statement. Okay, so let me come to your genius question. So of course, for gravity, there are a few subtleties that I would like to sort of mention very briefly. Namely, of course, in order to define this whole setup and say what do we mean by a UV mode and what do you mean by an infrared mode, we need some form of the metric. And so what we do here is that we take the full metric, which would be sort of the variable in the path integral.
There's a copy stick over there.
You think
I
it would
cannot
be...
see. I don't know if this laser is working very well.
So let me try to be more Canadian. all right. So we take our full metric and we split it into a background piece plus a fluctuation piece. And first of all, this is not perturbation theory, so this means that the fluctuation isn't restricted to be small. And this means that you can just write the path integral over the full metric as the path integral over the fluctuation. And so you don't lose or gain anything in the step here. But what you gain in this split here is that you can now generalize the momentum up here in the cutoff to the covariant Laplacian. And so this means you can write this mass-like term for the metric fluctuations. And so then you have the whole setup that you need in order to derive the flow equation or the Wetterich equation for quantum gravity. And this was first done in groundbreaking work by Martin Reuter in 96. Now, of course, in this step, what you do is that originally you have a shift symmetry where you simultaneously shift the background and the fluctuation. And if they combine back to just one metric, so the shift symmetry just tells you that that these two fields actually just combine back to one metric, and there isn't any sort of physical background metric. But of course, you can already see in this regulator term here that the shift symmetry is actually violated because this regulator term treats the fluctuation field and the background field very differently. And so technically, this has the consequence that couplings that belong to the background field and couplings that belong to the fluctuation field, which would run in exactly the same way if you had background independence, they actually run in different ways. And so this clearly enlarges our theory space because we now not only have the Newton coupling for the background field, but we also have the Newton coupling for the fluctuation field. And of course, the question is, how severe is the background dependence? And this is something that you can try to understand by looking at how different the background couplings and the fluctuation couplings run. And there is also a Ward identity that encodes the fact that originally we have background independence and we do have this shift symmetry. So the Ward identity encodes the remainder of the shift symmetry in the presence of the background term. And not sure whether you can actually see these references, but what you can see from the dates of these references is that there is rather recent work, 2015, 2016, starting to both explore the difference between background and fluctuation couplings in depth, and also starting to actually think about ways of imposing the shift Ward identity.
Astrid?
Yes?
Are you imposing some constraints on H mu nu so that G mu nu is a metric?
So there are different ways of doing this. So here for this linear split, strictly speaking, G mu nu isn't necessarily a metric, right? But what you can also do is a so-called exponential split, where essentially you just get g bar times the exponential of the fluctuation. And then you can show that for any value of the fluctuation field, g will always be a metric. And you can then check whether this difference in the parameterization of the fluctuations, whether that changes results very drastically, and it doesn't. So results in different truncations do depend on that choice of parameterization, but only within the limits that they usually depend on all these sort of non-universal choices like regulator and so on. Mm-hmm. Okay, and let me just also very briefly advertise that this whole setup can also be applied in other quantum gravity contexts, such as matrix and tensor models. So this is work that I did back here with Tim and that we recently picked up for tensor models. And that was then also generalized by a couple of former and present PI postdocs to the case of group field theories. So what I would now like to come back to is this question of, we saw that in the vicinity of two dimensions, there is this mechanism of balancing canonical scaling and quantum scaling in the beta function for the Newton coupling that seems to work and gives us a scale invariant regime. And we would like to understand whether with the FRG we can match onto these results and then extend them to the case of d equal 4. And I would just briefly like to highlight an example to show you that the FRG is a really suitable tool to do exactly that. So the FRG is a really great tool to take a perturbatively controlled fixed point that you can obtain with an epsilon expansion and then extend away from the critical dimension and see what the fixed point behaves like in other dimensions. And so this has been done in a variety of non-gravity models, and I would just like to briefly highlight one particular example. So the example here is critical ON models in 6 minus epsilon dimensions. So this was explored by Igor Klevanov and collaborators in 2014. They were mainly interested in it because this is an interesting model in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And what they looked at was ON models, so an ON scalar phi coupled to a second scalar z in 6 minus epsilon dimensions. And then they found an interacting fixed point in these two couplings, g and lambda, in the vicinity of 6 dimensions. But one of the interesting questions is how this fixed point actually behaves as you go towards integer epsilon, so as you go to 5 dimensions. And this is something that I did in collaboration with Lukas Janssen and Michael Scherer. So we took the FRG, explored the same type of model, and what you can see here is that in the vicinity of 6 dimensions, where you expect the epsilon expansion to work well, we match exactly onto the results from the epsilon expansion, and then we provide an extension towards the case of 5 dimensions, where, of course, the linear order in the epsilon expansion shouldn't be trusted anymore. Yes?
So if you go a little away from this fixed point, is that stable or is it positive?
If I remember correctly, that fixed point, it has, in this theory space, it has two relevant directions. So these are two directions that you have to tune in order to reach it towards the infrared. So these are infrared unstable directions, two of them. Okay. So that's exactly the same thing that you get in the vicinity of 6 dimensions, and it basically extends all the way down to 5 and below. And so one of the questions that we could provide an answer for with the FRG is the question, what is the critical value of n below which this fixed point ceases to exist? And you can answer that with the epsilon expansion in the vicinity of 6 dimensions. And with the FRG, we found that in the case of 5 dimensions, the critical lower value of n is actually equal to 1. So what I wanted to highlight with this example is that just that the FRG matches the epsilon expansion exactly, but then provides an extension away from the critical dimension. And so this is exactly the same thing that we want actually to do in gravity.
Is 6 dimensions the critical dimension for this?
Yes, because the sort of Yukawa type scalar interaction is dimensionless in 6 dimensions. So in the case of gravity, of course, we have the fixed point in the vicinity of 2 dimensions. And then the question is, can we match onto that with the FRG? And this is these are results by Andreas Nink and Kevin Falls mostly, who showed that you can reproduce exactly the beta function from 2 plus epsilon dimensions with the FRG. And then you can ask whether you can smoothly continue that fixed point as you go towards d equals 4. And so this is a plot. This is a result for the beta function by Kevin Falls. And this plot shows you the fixed point as a function of d. And smoothly going away from 2 dimensions, this fixed point simply extends and dies somewhere beyond six dimensions, but it extends smoothly between the well-controlled d equal 2 case towards the d equal 4 case that we are actually interested in. And so what I would now like to make is sort of the case for asymptotic safety in pure gravity. So of course, what we need to understand is just going beyond the beta function for just the Newton coupling. And here, the first truncation that was studied in great depth is one with the Newton coupling and a cosmological constant. And in this plot up here, you can see the interacting fixed point, which is UV attractive in both G and lambda. So it has two free parameters. And you can see that very well in this plot. You can essentially reach all these different values from G and lambda at low energies when you start from that fixed point up here. So we have two free parameters in that truncation. And then this truncation was extended in various ways. And by now, we do have sort of compelling hints that there is a fixed point which seems to feature three relevant directions as we go to larger and larger truncations in theory space. And I would like to highlight two of the more recent results. One of them is an f of r truncation, so just polynomials in r going up to largest value of n was n equals 35. And so this plot here is work by the Sussex group of Daniel Littim and his students and postdocs. And what you can see here is the negative critical exponents as you enlarge the truncation further and further. And the first thing to note is that down here we do have three relevant directions, so three positive critical exponents. And you can also see that their values actually fluctuate a little bit in the beginning when you have smaller truncations, but then as you extend the truncation further and further, these values stabilize. And so this already hints towards something like convergence as you extend the truncations. And the second really important thing to note here is that all of these higher order operators, r to the 3, r to the 4, and so on, canonically these are irrelevant. And at the interacting fixed point, all of them actually stay irrelevant. And so we do see that the interacting fixed point that we see exhibits near canonical scaling. And so this means that we do have a guidance to set up well-controlled truncations, because we simply have to ask whether an operator is relevant classically, and if so, then it is very likely to stay relevant. But when it is very irrelevant classically, then we can be pretty sure that it will stay irrelevant. And so this provides a scheme to set up truncations, and you can then check by calculations like that, where you go to a very high order, that scheme actually works extremely well and does exactly what you would expect. And so therefore, we do have a certain amount of control over the truncation. In contrast to what is sometimes stated. Yes?
So r squared is pushed into relevance?
So in this case, so here it, in this truncation here, it's r squared. Mm-hmm. But then if you look at r squared and r mu squared, it actually seems to be a combination of the two. So let me actually go to the next slide. So this is about more complicated tensor structures, like r squared and r mu squared. And then it's a combination of the two. Yes?
So you said something before that I didn't quite understand. You said that in general there would be different running for the background field. And for, so mm-hmm. which one are you showing us, the fluctuations?
Yeah, so here I'm showing you background results. But for instance, the result here by Nick Christiansen and also more recent results by some of the Heidelberg group that I'm not highlighting here are looking at the fluctuation running. And they actually see a similar picture. So if you look at the fluctuation couplings, you see a similar fixed point, you see a similar number of relevant directions, you see similarly sized critical exponents. And so there isn't a sort of extreme background dependence in most of the results. Also, one recent work that I would just like to highlight briefly is the inclusion of the Weyl cubed operator here. And so in these plots, what you see is the extension of the theory space by the coupling of the Weyl cubed operator. And this was a technically really very sophisticated work by a collaboration between Jena and Nijmegen. And essentially what you can see in these plots is that including this two-loop perturbative counterterm doesn't actually pose any problem at all. You simply see the further existence of the interacting fixed point as you take this direction into account. And so I would summarize the situation by saying that we do have compelling hints for asymptotic safety in pure gravity. And so the question that is keeping me awake at night is, what about observational viability? And what I would like to argue here is that in order to explore the observational viability of this quantum gravity model, or actually any quantum gravity model at all, we should be looking at quantum gravity and matter. And so let me make that case in a little bit more detail. So observable physics, at least in particle physics, is something that lives in the vicinity of the electroweak scale at, let's say, something like 10 to the 4 GeV. What we are mostly exploring in quantum gravity is things that live at the Planck scale at 10 to the 19 GeV, which isn't really currently observable. And then, of course, you can ask, well, is this actually physics, what we are doing, or not? And this was put into words much more eloquently by Dirac, who said that in any region of physics where very little is known, one must keep to the experimental basis if one is not to indulge in wild speculation that is almost certain to be wrong. Now, certainly wild speculation can be a lot of fun, at least for some time. But of course, ultimately, what we would like to be doing is to explore the properties of quantum space-time in our universe.
I think Dirac didn't believe in fun, yeah. I don't know.
Well, Dirac was guilty of some wild speculation.
Right. And so what I would like to argue is that when we include meta degrees of freedom into our quantum gravity models, that we can use that to forge a link between the electroweak scale, between physics that we know, and between the Planck scale, and that this link can ultimately allow us to put constraints on viable microscopic models, and ultimately, by understanding whether we can get back to known physics at the electroweak scale, we will be able to really put constraints on quantum gravity models and hopefully rule out classes of quantum gravity models. So specifically, I would like to do that for asymptotic safety. And so I'll be talking about an asymptotically safe model for gravity and matter. And of course, then this has two sides. There is the quantum gravity dynamics and the matter dynamics that couple to each other. And of course, in that case, there are two questions that come up. One is whether quantum fluctuations of matter can actually destroy the viable quantum gravity dynamics. And in the case of asymptotic safety, this boils down to the question of understanding what is the impact of matter on the gravitational fixed point. And the second question is, of course, whether quantum gravity fluctuations can generate a viable UV completion for matter. And let me explain this side in a little bit more detail. So first of all, why do we need a UV completion for the standard model? Well, the standard model isn't UV complete. It's a low energy effective theory. It does have a triviality problem in the scalar and in the abelian U1 sector. And the idea here is that these Landau poles, or the triviality problem, occurs somewhere beyond the Planck scale. And at the Planck scale, quantum fluctuations of gravity set in, and they change the scale dependence of the matter couplings. And of course, what they can in principle do is that quantum gravity fluctuations can generate a fixed point for matter. This can either be quantum gravity-induced asymptotic safety, so where the matter couplings just go to finite values in the UV, or it could also be quantum gravity-induced asymptotic freedom, where the running matter couplings just bend over again and go to zero in the far ultraviolet. And currently, we don't know which of these two possibilities, if any of them, is realized. Now, getting some UV completion for matter is actually not sufficient. We actually need to get a viable UV completion for matter, which means that if we have a fixed point that is quantum gravity-induced somewhere in the far UV, we actually need to be able to start from that fixed point and to flow back to known physics at the electroweak scale. So if there is a viable UV completion, then this fixed point up here has to be connected to the values of all the couplings in the standard model at the electroweak scale. Now, currently, there isn't any evidence from the LHC for physics between the electroweak scale and the Planck scale. And this makes the situation particularly interesting because it means that you can take just the standard model, no new physics on any scales in between, run it all the way up to the Planck scale, and then you have values for the couplings in the standard model at the Planck scale. And then you can ask the question whether the possible quantum gravity-induced fixed point up here, whether that can actually be matched onto the values of the couplings at the Planck scale.
So does the
yes?
fact that the Higgs self-coupling crosses zero, does that have any significance?
So this just means that here you are in a metastable situation, possibly. And then, of course, the question is, what do quantum gravity fluctuations do to the Higgs potential? So, of course, if quantum gravity fluctuations give you a Higgs potential, for instance, that is unbounded from below, then this whole setting is ruled out. So, yes, the question of the Higgs potential is important, and it's important to understand whether quantum gravity fluctuations give you a stable Higgs potential and also give you one where you can ultimately at low scales end up in the correct electroweak vacuum.
I guess what I'm wondering is that if the self-coupling is negative, then does the path integral even make sense?
Yes, it does, because the path integral doesn't just contain the quarter coupling, it also contains higher order couplings. It contains a full fixed point functional or a full functional for the potential, and you're just asking that potential has to be bounded from below. And then the question whether you know the expansion coefficient to fourth order around a particular point, whether that is positive or negative, that's actually not necessarily meaningful. The question whether the potential is bounded from below and what its minima are, that is meaningful. But it's not necessarily sufficient to just look at the quarter coupling to answer that.
One thing, but you mentioned that no current evidence of physics beyond the standard model puts us in an interesting situation. But if you use this particular matter arguments to constrain your quantum gravity models, then you're really constraining them only within this great desert hypothesis, because I can always
So some of the constraints I will be talking about really work best in a setting where you don't have any new physics or where you don't have any physics that impacts the particular coupling that I'm talking about. But there are also constraints that arise from the presence of a metasector that are independent of this assumption of whether you have new physics or not. So there will be both types of constraints. Okay, if I get to them. Okay, so let me first very briefly say something about the first question, namely, can quantum gravity fluctuations, can meta fluctuations destroy asymptotic safety in gravity? And the answer seems to be that in principle they could. So meta matters because quantum fluctuations of meta alter the UV dynamics for gravity. And this is something that you can see, for instance, in this plot. So this is various versions of the Newton coupling, the background Newton coupling, as well as fluctuation Newton couplings. And their fixed point values as a function of the number of scalars, and you see that they clearly change and grow towards large values. And so ultimately, if the impact of scalar fluctuations becomes too big, it can destroy the gravity fixed point, at least in this setting. And this explains this plot here. So this is the plane spent by the number of scalars and number of Dirac fermions, and you don't get any viable fixed point up here in this white regime, at least in the truncation that we investigated. So the critical thing in this setting probably is that if you look at the standard model meta content, you do get an asymptotically safe gravity fixed point, but this is not necessarily true for arbitrary meta models.
Sorry, where is the standard model?
The standard model is at 4 scalars and 22.5 Dirac fermions, which means somewhere up here. And this is a plot at 12 vectors, which is just the number for the standard model. Mm-hmm. So the standard model seems to be safe, at least within that truncation. Now let me come to that second question, namely what are the chances for a quantum gravity-induced UV completion for matter? And what I would like to advertise here is some recent work on an asymptotically safe UV completion, an asymptotically safe solution to the U1 triviality problem. So this was first looked at back in 2011 by Ulrich Haas and Martin Reuter. They explored an Einstein-Hilbert gravity sector coupled to a field strength squared for the abelian gauge coupling GU1. And they found the following beta function. So this is just the standard meta contribution that generates the triviality problem. And then there is a gravity contribution, which comes with a negative sign. And you see that in the vicinity of the non-interacting of the free fixed point, the gravity contribution is leading. And because of the negative sign, it generates an asymptotically free fixed point up here. So this is this fixed point up here at a finite value of the Newton coupling, at a vanishing value of the gauge coupling, and it's ultraviolet attractive in both directions. And so this suggests that there could be something like quantum gravity-induced asymptotic freedom. So what I did together with my postdoc, Nick Christiansen, is we took a slightly sharper look at this question, and we realized that the case is not quite as simple because there are actually quantum gravity-induced photon interactions. So specifically, if you just start by writing down this field strength squared term, this of course contains factors of the metric, and this allows you to construct diagrams with, for instance, 4 external photons and metric fluctuations. And so this is a quantum gravity-generated 4-photon interaction, which is of course encoded in this field strength to the 4 operator. And we call it the corresponding coupling of that W2. And if you look at the beta function for that coupling W2, then of course it has a variety of different contributions. But the important one in this setting is this one, which comes from quantum gravity, and which clearly has the effect that setting W2 equal to 0 no longer gives you a fixed point of the beta function. So therefore, the free fixed point in the coupling W2 is shifted towards an interacting fixed point. So in other words, in the far UV, quantum gravity induces four photon interactions. So this means that matter models can actually not become completely asymptotically free in the presence of asymptotically safe gravity. It always induces some residual interactions in the very far UV. And this can actually have really interesting consequences. And you can see them by just looking at the beta function for that coupling again. So the blue curve is the one without any quantum gravity effects. And it has a free fixed point where the coupling W2 is irrelevant. And then as you switch on gravity fluctuations, you get a shift in the beta function so that the fixed point in the coupling W2 is shifted to a finite value. So this means we will get the photon-photon interactions in the UV. But then if gravity fluctuations become stronger, you actually shift the beta function even further until there is no real fixed point left, and the only fixed point lies in the complex plane. And that is, of course, phenomenologically not acceptable. And so this means that in order to actually get a viable fixed point in the matter sector, gravity must remain sufficiently weak. It can't exceed a certain interaction strength. If it does, then the matter sector simply breaks. And you can also see the same thing if you then include further couplings, such as, for instance, the cosmological constant. Essentially, what this plot is showing you here is that there is a regime of sort of strong gravity, and that regime is excluded because in that regime you can't get any viable matter fixed points. So the structure that we see here for the quantum gravity induced matter fixed point is the following. For the higher order photon-photon interaction, we do get an interacting fixed point. And then the question is whether the abelian gauge coupling GU1, whether that can actually become or remain asymptotically free. And in order to answer that question, we have to look at the critical exponent of that coupling. So the critical exponent has to remain larger than 0. For the abelian U1 coupling to become asymptotically free. And now the critical exponent has two contributions. It has a direct quantum gravity contribution, and this is the one that is this orange line here, which is positive. So this strengthens asymptotic freedom. Here is that there is a regime of additional sort of contribution gravity, which comes from the generated new photon-photon interactions. And this is what we call the mediated interaction. It's in some sense also a quantum gravity effect, but it's a quantum gravity effect that is mediated through the induced matter interactions. And to understand whether the abelian gauge coupling can become asymptotically free, we need to take into account both of these effects. And so, yes?
So, is it possible to have a quantum gravity induced coupling, say, in abelian gauge theories that could prove to be a threat to asymptotic freedom?
Yes, so this is one of the things on the to-do list. Hopefully we'll have an answer very soon. So then there are different... Yes?
Why do we care whether the abelian coupling becomes... I mean, if you have this F to the 4 term, why do we care whether... What happens with the F squared term?
So I'll come back to that too, but of course what we definitely need in order for this whole setup to be consistent, we care about whether there is actually a fixed point or not. Yeah. Right, and so this means that there is this regime for the gravity fluctuations, which is completely excluded, because here gravity is too strong to support a fixed point in the matter sector at all. And then there's an intermediate regime, and that's the one where these gravity-induced interactions dominate, and they still give you a fixed point, but now it's one where the abelian gauge coupling isn't asymptotically free; it's actually irrelevant at that fixed point. And this is potentially a problem for the following reason. So the abelian gauge coupling will just run with k to the power of minus the critical exponent. And so this means if the critical exponent is negative, then the abelian gauge coupling is actually forced to remain 0 all the way down to the Planck scale. So in this red regime here, you will get an abelian gauge coupling which vanishes at the Planck scale. And then, of course, if you look at the standard model and make this assumption that there is no physics that impacts the running of the abelian gauge coupling, then starting from a value of 0, you can't actually reconcile that with the finite value of the abelian gauge coupling at the Planck scale in the standard model.
I see. So asymptotic freedom in this case is a bad thing.
No, asymptotic freedom is a good thing.
I mean for the F squared.
No, so I mean you can have a free fixed point, but at the free fixed point, that coupling must be relevant. So in that sense, it must be really asymptotically free, just as the non-abelian gauge coupling, because then you can reach any value in the infrared. So it, it, the region is excluded where this coupling becomes irrelevant. Yeah. And that, that actually leaves us with a more narrow region for the possible values of the sort of strength of the gravity interactions. This is the phenomenologically viable region in the sense that here we do get a fixed point, and it's actually one that we can connect to the values of the couplings at the Planck scale and then run down to physics as we know it at the electroweak scale without having to make the assumption that there is new physics at scales in between which will fix our problems. So this is really a regime which all the way from the far UV all the way down to the electroweak scale would be consistent, at least in the abelian sector. So let's see how much of the material I will get through. So let me explain a little bit more about the general quantum gravity-induced fixed-point structure in the matter sector that we understand now. So we saw here in the gauge sector that there's a structure where we have higher-order interactions which are induced and which have an interacting fixed point, and then some of the other couplings actually remain free. And this actually seems to be a general picture in all the different truncations that have been studied. We find fixed points where some of the matter couplings remain free, and other of the other matter couplings actually are interacting. And of course, one of the crucial questions when you observe such a picture in a variety of truncations is to understand which of the couplings are those that remain free and which are the couplings that remain finite in the ultraviolet. And what we understand now is that it's actually symmetries in the matter sector that dictate that fixed point structure for the gravity matter sector. And to understand that, let me highlight the fermion scalar sector. So this is work which was done mainly in collaboration with my PhD student, Aaron Held. So in the scalar fermion sector, if you just look at the kinetic terms, you have a particular symmetry, for instance, an axial U1 symmetry for the fermions, and for the scalars, you have a reflection symmetry as well as a shift symmetry. And what quantum gravity does, it takes the kinetic terms and generates matter interactions from those kinetic terms, but those matter interactions that are generated have to respect the symmetries of the separate kinetic terms. And therefore, it's sort of peculiar matter interactions which are generated. So this is something like a sort of Yukawa interaction. It's an interaction between fermions and scalars, but it's not the interaction that you would typically look at in the case of the standard model because it's a derivative interaction. So these are derivative couplings, and for these couplings, gravity gives us non-vanishing fixed point values. Now, in contrast, if you look at the canonical couplings in the standard model, they typically have a reduced symmetry in contrast to the separate kinetic terms. And in the setting of asymptotic safety, quantum gravity fluctuations actually preserve the global symmetries. And this means that they give us beta functions for these interaction terms, which are always proportional to the coupling and therefore always feature free fixed points. And so the symmetry structure that we have in the matter sector that is induced by gravity is what we call a minimally interacting fixed point. It's free in all those couplings with a reduced symmetry, which actually covers all the canonical standard model couplings, but it's interacting in the couplings which have the full symmetry of the kinetic terms, so it's interacting in these higher order couplings. And in that setting, there are then two really interesting questions to understand, namely whether these couplings that you induce, whether they can actually remain real, or whether they are shifted off into the complex plane. And secondly, whether the standard model couplings actually become relevant or irrelevant in that setting. And if they become irrelevant, of course, we could predict their values. And let me first highlight the first case, namely the first question, namely the one about the reality of the induced couplings. Yes?
Don't some of these global symmetries have anomalies? Is that not?
In the standard model, possibly, yes. So not in these toy models.
In this case, they don't. Is that it?
Yes, in this case, they don't. So in the case of the gauge fields, we already saw that these induced interactions are the photon-photon interactions, and they exclude a certain region in the gravitational parameter space. Here, gravity becomes too strong to support a fixed point in the matter sector. And actually, the very same thing is true if you look at the fermion and scalar sector. So again, you have a particular induced interaction, and you have a very similar structure of the beta function, as a function of a growing gravitational interaction strength, the beta function is shifted so that you don't get real fixed points in the case where gravity becomes too strong. And so here I'm showing you essentially the same plot, but obtained from the fermion scalar system. And again, there is a region that is ruled out because quantum gravity fluctuations become too strong. And so we now have indications for requirements of some form of weak gravity from these completely independent matter sectors. And so this means that from the observation of matter degrees of freedom, from the simple knowledge that we do have something like photons or fermions and scalars, we know that the gravity fixed point can't lie in a certain regime, because in that regime it would not give us a viable fixed point for the matter. Of course, all of these statements are true within certain truncations. So one of the things that we are checking is how much this region actually depends on the truncation that we make in the gravity sector. But the qualitative result that gravity has to remain in some sense weak in order to give us a viable fixed point for matter, that actually seems to be true. So the second thing that I would like to briefly highlight is the question of what about those couplings that have a free fixed point? Do they become relevant or irrelevant? And specifically here, I would like to take a look at the Yukawa coupling, specifically the top Yukawa coupling, which has a sizable value at the Planck scale, and where we can ask, can this be connected to a viable ultraviolet fixed point or not? And this is within a toy model where we are not looking at the full Higgs-Yukawa sector of the standard model, but just as at a toy model with one scalar and one fermion. And here, you can then evaluate the beta function for the Yukawa coupling, and it gives you a fixed point at a vanishing value of the Yukawa coupling. And the question is, starting from that fixed point, can you actually get to this value of the Yukawa coupling at the Planck scale or not? And there are, in principle, two scenarios. One of them is that the critical exponent from that gravity induces is negative, and in that case, the value of the Yukawa coupling is actually pressed towards zero by quantum gravity fluctuations. And specifically, if you start from that fixed point up here, the value for the Yukawa coupling has to remain zero all the way down to the Planck scale. And clearly, comparing that to the top Yukawa coupling doesn't really give you a very good match. Now, in contrast, if quantum gravity fluctuations make that coupling relevant, this means that starting from a fixed point value of zero, it can grow all the way towards the Planck scale, and then you can easily accommodate any value of that coupling at the Planck scale. And now what we looked at recently is the question, if we look at a gravitational parameter space that contains all sorts of gravity couplings, the Newton coupling, cosmological constant, as well as higher order gravity couplings, where in this parameter space do we actually get the setting that is observationally viable? And essentially what this plot here shows you is that from the requirement that within that toy model we can match the right value of the top Yukawa coupling, from that requirement you can actually rule out half of the gravitational parameter space. Now, of course, this is true within this particular toy model, so you shouldn't take these actual numbers too seriously, but the message here is that from the requirement that you match onto known physics at or below the Planck scale, you can actually impose significant constraints on the microscopic gravity model. Now, since we had quite a bit of questions, let me actually just briefly go through to this question here in the remaining 2 minutes. So this is, again, looking at the Yukawa coupling and realizing that in the standard model, the Yukawa couplings are everything that are the only source of fermion masses. They are everything that generates the masses. There are no microscopic fermion mass terms in the standard model. And this is because the standard model has a chiral symmetry. It treats left and right-handed fermions independently. And the question that I addressed together with Stefan Lippold was the question whether this chiral symmetry can be understood as some sort of emergent symmetry, that quantum gravity somehow generates chiral symmetry, or whether, conversely, this can be understood as a constraint on the fundamental model. And in order to do that, we just looked at a particular truncation that does include chiral symmetry violating terms like a mass term and higher order interactions. And the main message is that in this theory space, we then need to end up on this green surface in the infrared, because this green surface, that is the one that has chiral symmetry, that is the one where we find the standard model. And the question is, when we start anywhere off the critical surface, do quantum gravity fluctuations force us towards this symmetry-enhanced surface or not? And the answer is that in general, quantum gravity fluctuations, and this is both within asymptotic safety as well as within an effective field theory setting, in both cases, quantum gravity fluctuations drive us away from the surface with chiral symmetry. And so therefore, chiral symmetry is not an emergent or an infrared attractive symmetry. It means that if you build a microscopic model of gravity and fermions, and you don't enforce some version of chiral symmetry, you will not get chiral symmetry in the infrared. And so clearly this means that there is a constraint on the microscopic models. You have to put in something that can become chiral symmetry in the infrared. And in the setting of asymptotic safety, we do actually find a fixed point that is chirally symmetric and that allows us to realize chiral symmetry on all scales. So within asymptotic safety, we can accommodate that constraint. So let me just come to my conclusions. So what I try to do here is to convince you that quantum gravity might actually be able to provide an ultraviolet completion for the standard model. Of course, for people with a string theory background, this is a very familiar thought. Specifically, I addressed this question in the framework of asymptotic safety, and I told you that we have indications that there is an asymptotically safe solution to the U1 triviality problem, because we do get a quantum gravity-induced fixed point for the abelian gauge coupling. But the existence of that fixed point, as well as the existence of a fixed point in other matter sectors, actually requires some form of weak gravity. So we restrict the viable gravitational parameter space simply from the observation that there is matter, which should also have a UV fixed point. And then secondly, if we demand that the matter fixed point is phenomenologically viable, then this actually provides us with yet another way to constrain the gravitational parameter space. And finally, one of the things that I think should be tested in any quantum gravity model is whether chiral fermions can be accommodated. So we saw that chiral symmetry is not infrared attractive, and so therefore it's a non-trivial constraint on quantum gravity models to be able to accommodate chiral fermions. They can be accommodated within asymptotically safe quantum gravity, where we do find trajectories that respect chiral symmetry on all scales. So this is an outlook. Where this research is going is essentially standard model plus gravity, and asking the question whether there is a joint fixed point that is observationally viable. And stay tuned for the answer. And thanks for your attention. Yes?
I said, can you go back to the slide where you have the excluded out for the parameter space?
Yes.
Square gravity. Yes, this one.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us a bit more about what part of parameter space is excluded? Is there any bound on A?
Yes, so it turns out that the more relevant bounds arise on B and D, because A and C actually don't enter the transverse traceless part of the graviton propagator. So they enter the part which is the trace mode, which of course contributes off-shell to the path integral, but the transverse traceless mode is of course much more dominant than the trace mode, and therefore we find that the relevant constraints in this setting are imposed on B and D. And so this B effective here is essentially just something like B minus D divided by the Newton coupling or something like that.
And do you have to extract from Rn mu squared the bind part? Are you making a statement about bind squared?
You can reformulate that into a statement of bind squared, but I haven't done that.
Okay, so the message
you
is
could.
Not bound on A.
So if you look at this thing in a sort of B over A plane, you find that essentially it's independent of A. And this is simply a consequence of the dominance of the transverse traceless part.
Thank you.
So is that good for you?
Well, no, if inflation is driven by R squared, then there are...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then you could claim that there's a measurement of A.
A is huge, right? It's like
10 to the 10 Planck length squared.
10 to the 10.
Okay, well, we typically, sort of fixed point values tend to lie somewhere in this region here, so this is what we've looked at. So I would have to check 10 to the 10 whether this actually is compatible or not. Yeah.
You've been looking at metric gravity.
Yeah.
What happens to first order gravity?
For the case of gravity and matter, of course, I mean, for fermions, we always just look at the field line, but we don't treat sort of additional degrees of freedom as independent. We reformulate them just as metric fluctuations. Now, in the case of pure gravity, people have looked at sort of first-order formulations and also taken into account I think, torsion terms and things like that. And it becomes technically much, much more challenging. If I recall correctly, in most of the settings where very small truncations have only been explored, you do find some indications for fixed points. But sort of the main idea is that, you know, observationally, metric gravity seems to work quite well. So why should we include additional gravitational degrees of freedom that make the path integral more complicated? But in principle, you could generalize that setting to sort of any path integral, whatever your variables are.
My question is related then. In the most general truncation or effective action you consider, how many propagating degrees of freedom do you get for the metric? Oh.
So see, this is one of the difficult questions because, I mean, within a truncation where you go to, let's say, r to the 10 or something, right, of course, you have 20 derivatives, so this would sort of classically correspond to a certain number of initial conditions that you have to make, and also if you look at the propagator in the quantum theory, you will typically get additional poles. But these are induced by the fact that you're truncating something which you actually know is an infinite series. So, for instance, f of r will be the full functional that doesn't stop at r to the 20. It really extends all the way up to r to the arbitrary high powers. But whenever you're truncating a series like that, you get additional truncation-induced poles. But you know that they will go away, or they can go away as you go to higher orders. And so in some sense, this question of, you know, what are the propagating degrees of freedom in that setting? Of course, it's an important question, but you can't answer it straightforwardly in truncations by just looking at, you know, what are the poles of the propagator, because there will be lots of truncation-induced poles which aren't meaningful at all.
But do you have evidence that if you include everything, these poles will go away, these truncation-induced poles will go away?
So currently, we don't know, but there is work by the group in Nijmegen that is going on who are really trying to understand the restrictions on theory space that arise from the requirement of having a unitary propagator. So, of course, in the end, what this translates to is just the full infinite-dimensional theory space, just certain regions of that support a unitary theory, other regions of that will support theories with extra poles that you don't want. And so they are working on understanding these restrictions, I think, at the moment in a scalar setting. But, of course, ultimately, you can then generalize that to the gravitational setting, and then you have a sort of allowed and a forbidden part of theory space, and then you can check where the fixed point lies. But I think that's still sort of further ahead in the roadmap.
Should you at least get the scalar from the Starobinsky term?
If you look at these truncations, like, you know, stop at r squared, then, of course, you know, if you take that seriously as this really being the full action, then that would have additional propagating degrees of freedom.
You say that too, the scalar one for from r squared can go away if in a more general sense.
Yes, so if you have the full propagator, the poles could, in principle, lie anywhere. But if you truncate it at r squared and you insist on that being the physical propagator, then that will have an additional propagating mode.
So you said gravity has to be sufficiently weak for compatibility with matter, and then you have this original sort of stripped down model with pure gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible to say at that fixed point whether it's weak enough?
Yes. So actually, if we look at these constraints and ask, well, where does the fixed point for gravity, also taking into account matter fluctuations, where does it fall into? It, for all that we know so far, it falls into the allowed regime. So it's weak. I think it sort of the weak is a similar weak as the statement that the fixed point isn't strongly interacting in the sense that, for instance, the scaling dimensions of the operators aren't that far away from perturbative scaling. So I think the weak in what I see here, you can probably interpret it in a similar way. That is sort of near perturbative or near canonical, but it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be fully perturbative or anything like that.
So let me try a comment, see if you agree. It's only meant heuristically, but it seems to me that if it's not gravity is not weak in the asymptotic regime near your fixed point, then the whole scheme might be just inconsistent because it's all based on doing things like expansions about a flat background metric. And if the gravity is strong, one would expect who knows, you know, complicated topology, if not complicated topology, at least very high curvature comparable to the energy scale one was at, and then these kind of techniques wouldn't really be suitable for that regime.
So, I mean, we are not doing perturbation theory in the sense of we're just taking into account small fluctuations, but of course, by using the background method, of course, we are sort of fixing, for instance, the topology of the background. So that does, I think, restrict certain classes of fluctuations in the path integral. But then, of course, you know, for instance, for the heat kernel, you can, of course, do things where you just take the first heat kernel coefficients into account, and that would correspond to an expansion around weak coupling. But you can also look at something like really functions f of r, where you take into account the full heat kernel, not just the expanded version with the first few coefficients. And I think this isn't necessarily then restricted by this sort of requirement that you have to be sort of anywhere near flat space or that you couldn't have large curvature. But of course, if we go away from this sort of weak gravity regime into a fully fledged, extremely non-perturbative setting, then this will presumably mean that the truncation scheme that we use, namely the guidance from the canonical scaling dimension, that will break down completely. And then, of course, it's much, much more difficult to gain qualitative and quantitative control of the fixed point.
When you do the practical calculations, aren't you assuming a background metric which is either flat or something of low curvature? Or would you
deny that you're doing that? You can use things like, for instance, spheres.
Well, spheres are pretty...
Depends on the radius, right? Whether they are low or high curvature.
Okay, but they're still very, very regular.
I mean, we typically use maximally symmetric spaces. Not always, but in many cases.
But that's interesting also, because one way that the gravitational field could be strong is if the radius of those spheres was too small. If the cosmological constant was too large, you might get strong effects from that, which would be of interest.
So in fact, in these plots that I sort of went over a little more quickly, you can actually also look at the effect of the cosmological constant. So this mu here is essentially just a sort of the fluctuation field version of the cosmological constant. And there are definitely regimes where you make the cosmological constant too large. So this is larger and positive cosmological constant. And there you also run into a forbidden regime. So one of the ways indeed is to just make the gravity, the Newton coupling large, but also going into a particular region for the cosmological constant is also something that makes gravity fluctuations too strong, and that seems to be ruled out from our results here.
Is it ruled out, or is there a phase transition to a different kind of phase?
To a sort of a phase that isn't describable in sort of geometric or metric degrees of freedom? In principle, yes, maybe. I think if there is a phase transition to a sort of pre-geometric regime, then it's more difficult to describe it within this setting here. So then we would have to go to something with, for instance, like, you know, maybe spin forms or maybe something like tensor models, something that is more adapted to dealing with a phase where the sort of metric doesn't have an expectation value.
What if you did that a different way? What if you kept the cosmological constant in Planck units small, but you kept all the masses even smaller? Could there be a different phase where, say, the masses associated with the gauge couplings or with the scalars were very small, so the relevant length scales were very large on cosmological scales. Can you explore that regime?
So I think the fixed point that we are typically seeing is actually one where all the masses are very small. So in particular, there is a fixed point where the mass of the scalar, for instance, would just go to zero. So that is, in fact, the regime that we are typically exploring, and where we do see this fixed point. So it's not a regime where the masses become large. It's a regime where the masses actually go to zero towards the fixed point.
And is there another phase? What I'm looking for, I can tell you later why, is a phase where we get a different physics from when all the length scales become large compared to the cosmological constant length scale. Including all the quantum wavelengths.
So this might be sort of a regime that we have here, but yeah, I would have to think about it in more detail.
Okay. So why do you care about that regime?
You care about it under a different name if you think about it.
Okay.
That's the Mondrisian.
The Mondrisian. Ah.
When the Mondrisian scales in your problem are large compared to the distance to the cosmological horizon, you're in a different phase that doesn't need to be connected to your Euclidean space.
So I guess I was thinking that maybe a different way of thinking about the same problem, not the Mond, but the cosmological constant problem is, I guess if you have a purely scale free theory with like wild gravity, and then something breaks the scale invariance, could you get like a hierarchy between the mass scales and the cosmological constant scale from that? Because there is, I guess the distance, is that true? Do I remember this correctly? So the distance between the TeV scale, but the Higgs mass scale and the Planck mass is the same distance from like cosmological constant scale to the TeV scale. So
I think that's about right, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, so in this whole sort of paradigm of asymptotic safety, there's always a possible interesting twist to all sorts of hierarchy problems.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, hierarchy problems typically come because you have, you know, something that depends quartically or quadratically on the cutoff. So that's the canonical scaling.
Yeah.
But now if you go to an interacting fixed point, you have non-trivial corrections to the scaling. And in principle, they could be such that, you know, the true scaling of an operator that has canonical dimension 2, the full scaling could be lowered to something that is close to zero, for instance. And then you would just end up with logarithmic running, and that wouldn't give you a hierarchy problem. So, right? So in principle, the fact that you are at an interacting fixed point here can give you a way to, in principle, solve hierarchy problems. Of course, in practice, you have to check for each case whether that is actually realized or not. Now, for the cosmological constant, it turns out that this is a relevant parameter in this setting here, which has a critical exponent, which is also of the order 2. So it doesn't, in fact, change the usual sort of fine-tuning problem. So it's just fine-tuning problem is still there. If we want to have the small value of the cosmological constant, we can accommodate that. So there is a trajectory coming from the fixed point going towards that regime, but it's a sort of a non-generic trajectory in the sense that you have to fine-tune it, and it has to be a trajectory that passes close to the origin of theory space. But then maybe for some of the other parameters, like, for instance, for the Higgs mass parameter, where you also have a hierarchy problem, the question whether quantum gravity fluctuations shift the critical exponent for the Higgs so that you at least solve that partially, that is an open question.
I was thinking whether you could couple those two problems to each other, that the Higgs mass problem and the cosmological constant. And it's not obvious to me. You're kind of looking at perturbations around Einstein gravity, but could you instead do perturbations around wild gravity?
Yeah, so this is essentially just the choice of truncation. Right. Once you fix your theory space and say that it has to contain all the diffeomorphism invariant operators, then of course, you know, this contains both of the settings, and in principle you could also start with a truncation that is just via gravity.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, so in the setting here, at least, you know, things like so you're thinking about wild squared gravity, right? The scale.
Right. So the wild squared plus wild squared on its own, I guess, doesn't have any scale in it.
Yes.
But then if you start running it, then you're gonna produce?
Well, presumably you have the same thing like in Young-Mills theory, right? It's classically scale invariant, but there will be quantum effects that generate a scale for you, and you get a non-trivial running. So,
So could you get cosmological constant from that, basically? And Einstein gravity, presumably. So you can get Higgs mass from that, cosmological constant from that.
So presumably if you start with something like just wild squared, you will presumably generate the running for the other terms.
Yeah.
But I would assume that then we just get back to that setting here, so where you then see that fixed point that I've been talking about here, where we just typically start with truncations that already include Einstein-Hilbert, because if you generate them anyway, then you can include these terms from the beginning.
So you think there's an...
Yes?
So in all these examples that you find, you say the fixed point, how does the fixed point change when you increase the truncation, for example? How much does...
I showed you this plot for the f of r case, which I think is the sort of nicest example where you see that. So here you can see quite well that if you look, for instance, at the critical exponents, for small truncations, they can vary quite a bit, right? For instance, there's this case where you just include r squared, where it suddenly jumps down and then only starts to stabilize. And also you see here that if you include the higher order operators, when they are first included, their critical exponents jump around quite a bit, and then they become more and more stable as you go to higher and higher orders in the truncation. And so what you see here is that in truncations where you first include an operator, that sort of for the first few truncations where this is the new operator that you've added, you can easily get variations of, you know, like 1 to 2, 4, 5, things like that. Right? But then, as you can see here, they typically tend to stabilize as you go to higher and higher order. And then also the other thing, for instance, that, you know, if you add something like the vial cubed, so from the reasoning that I've introduced previously about, you know, near canonical scaling, you would expect that this is an irrelevant operator, and you do the calculation, and in fact, at the fixed point that you find in this theory space, it is in fact an irrelevant operator. And so things seem to follow this scheme quite well. And we also see that in the meta sector, those operators that we expect to be irrelevant in the meta sector indeed seem to stay irrelevant at the fixed point.
So can you extrapolate to some characteristics that you would expect of the theory that is at this fixed point?
In fact, I would expect that this question of 3, possibly 4 relevant directions, that from all that we know seems to be rather stable. So I would expect that, you know, if we now continue to add higher order in vial, that all of them remain irrelevant. That would be an expectation that you could build from that. And so you could definitely at the moment, based on these ideas here, build a sort of classification of theory space where you would have a pretty good idea what would be relevant and what should remain irrelevant if this scheme holds.
Two last questions.
Okay, maybe what I'm going to say is completely wrong, so interrupt me at any point if it is wrong. But I thought in the standard model, there's no exact chiral symmetry. So that's in relation to what you were saying about...
So I'm talking about the microscopic masses, right? I mean, of course, you do get the effect of chiral symmetry breaking and QCD, for instance, at low energies. But I'm talking about microscopic scales, so around the Planck scale and below. So the chiral symmetry breaking effect set in at the electroweak scale and at the QCD scale. But above that, there aren't any, the chiral symmetry is exact, and you really don't have any microscopic fermion masses. All the masses in the standard model are generated through chiral symmetry breaking, electroweak symmetry breaking at low scales. So if we're talking about Planck scale physics...
That's a separate statement. That's not quite true, is it? Because you have masses in pure QCD, and unless somehow there was some firewall that separated them from the fermion sector, there would be some masses there too. They might not be as large as the ones.
You mean chiral symmetry break? Chiral symmetry is spontaneously broken when you couple fermions with chiral couplings to gauge fields. Is that the?
I mean, so in QCD, you have two fermion masses, right? So you have the sort of, if you're just looking at QCD, typically people put in small fermion masses of, I don't know, MeV for the UND quarks? So these are the masses that are generated through chiral symmetry breaking through the electroweak sectors. So these are the fermion masses that are generated through the coupling to the Higgs by the Yukawa coupling. And then there's a much bigger effect that actually gives most of the proton mass that is chiral symmetry breaking through non-perturbative QCD. But if you really look at the standard model before these two symmetry breaking effects, so at higher scales, you're not putting a microscopic mass.
But does violate chiral symmetry, doesn't it?
No, left and right handed fermions are still separate, right? Because only the left handed ones transform under the and the SU2 are coupled to the SU2. And you can't write a microscopic mass term for, let's say, the U quark. That would violate that symmetry.
Is it fair to say that this concern of yours with chiral symmetry is analogous to why one would want the cancellation of the chiral anomaly in the standard model?
It's really that if you break chiral symmetry through gravity effects, then you can just write then you write microscopic mass terms, or really something like m psi, psi bob psi.
Right.
And typically, I mean, since that mass is coming from quantum gravity effects, it will be big. So it will actually lead to fermions, which are sort of typically Planck size mass, right? And so you can never get to the standard model, which has masses which are all much below the Planck scale.
So, Lee, do you have a last comment? Or?
A last comment. Can you say anything about far infrared effects? Newton's constant going to the far infrared or axions or something.
So the sort of far infrared on sort of galactic or sort of cosmological scales, it's a really interesting question. And there are a few first truncations where you can check what happens. I wouldn't say that at the moment those results have converged yet, but there are some results where what you'd recover in the infrared would simply be classical scaling, which would in some sense be extremely boring. So in that case, you wouldn't see any sort of huge quantum gravity effects resurfacing at cosmological scales. But at the moment, I would say that question is probably still open, whether there is a possibility to get sort of a second non-trivial fixed point in the infrared, which would then give you interesting cosmology. That's certainly an open possibility.
Do you have the tools to investigate?
So in principle, this whole setup, you can use that over the whole range of scales. But of course, truncations that work well in the ultraviolet don't necessarily have to be truncations that also work well in the infrared. And so this whole question of what is an important operator to include and how do we set up the truncation, you might have to rethink that when starting to address questions about the infrared. But in principle, this whole setup can address both UV and infrared.
Okay, and if the cosmological constant is positive, mm-hmm. then there's a de Sitter temperature. Does that mean that you have to compute thermal effects on the renormalization of the coupling constants in the
Yes, probably. I've never thought of that, but yes, you would have to actually go to a finer temperature setting if you're going to the deep infrared.
Has anybody investigated that?
So you can apply this whole FRG setup at finer temperature. So you do so in the cases of things like, for instance, QCD plasma and so on. People have done that, in principle, you could carry that over to the case of quantum gravity. It would be technically complicated, but it's definitely doable.
No, I haven't. If you go to the
Thank you, Astrid.